caffeinated Christian.
It reminded me of Hamilton.
Oh, yeah. I got gal, yeah, gal, yeah. What time is it? Podcast time.
Yay.
Yeah, that was gross. But hi, guys. Welcome to Caffeinated Christians. This is the sixth episode of Caffeinated Christians. This is insane that we've been doing this for 6 weeks.
Six?
Yeah. Episode number six.
Oh.
I don't know. But that's number great. Six, which is amazing. Yeah. Welcome. We're talking about the Nevi'im today, which you're probably like, what is the Nevi'im? That sounds like a funny word. Because that word is not as familiar as the word Torah is. And so we're excited to get into this podcast. I'm going to be real with y'all. I did a little bit of research for this one. Holly did a butt ton of research for this.
No.
So, yes, she did. So, you're going to be hearing a ton more from Holly this podcast, which I'm excited for y'all to hear her talk about, especially her favorite book in the Old Testament, Judges. So, y'all are going to hear a lot of really good stuff from Holly. She's going to kind of take over here in a little bit, and so I'm really excited for y'all to hear from her. So, without further ado, let's get into this. So, the Nevi'im. What is the Nevi'im? So, it is comprised of 19 books of the Old Testament, and it is divided into two parts, the former prophets and the latter prophets. This is kind of where our Bibles begin to differentiate. We're kind of looking at the Old Testament right now from a Jewish Bible standpoint because that is how it was originally written, and we're trying to, you know, take it back to the context. That's what we're all about here. And so, this is where the Greek or the, I guess, Pentecostal version, or the whatever, our Bible, differentiates from the Tanakh. So, for the Nevi'im, we have the former prophets, which you're going to kind of be surprised about, is Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And Samuel and Kings are not split up into two different books like it is in our Bible. It is just one long scroll for them. And then the latter prophets, which are, you know, what we know. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Then we have the minor, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Handful. So we'll kind of get into those here in just a second. So in our Bibles, the former prophets, so Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, are all into the historical books. We have history is for our Bible. Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. Those are all in the historical books. Half of those books that I just mentioned are not in the Torah, they're not in the prophets, they're in the writings, which we'll get into next week. Now that's a whole other thing. So, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And so these are put into the prophets. Scholars believe that they're put in the prophets because they have a lot of prophetic activity within them. Kind of like all of the latter prophets are written by prophets. All of the former prophets, minus Samuel, who was a prophet, have major prophetic activity within them, have prophets constantly being chosen and rising up to be speakers for Israel, and kings especially. Each king was not appointed without a prophet, whether or not that prophet was from God. They were not appointed without a prophet, and Samuel also has a lot to do in Kings. And so that is why they believe, or scholars believe, or historians believe, that they were involved in the prophet books, prophets, instead of a whole other subject. And so history in Israel was basically before the 19th century was very didactic in nature. Basically what that means is that it was a subject to teach people how to be good citizens and good stewards of the religion rather than, look at us, like, writing down all these facts and information and keeping record. History was just a very different thing before the 19th century. And so, these books were not majorly, historical in our sense, but more so historical for the Israelites because it was teaching them how to be good stewards of, Judaism and following God and following Yahweh. And so they were not interested in recording real events, and they were more concerned with using narratives set in the past to illustrate various issues of significance to their communities, in this case Israel. And so we're able to see throughout the four former prophets, which are in our historical books, they're very much written in narrative form. And so it's a story. It's like, oh, this person did this thing, and then after that, this is what happened after that, and what happened after this, and blah blah blah. And so It's a very different, I guess, mindset rather than, you know, the way we view history and historical books and what we deem as true was very different than how it was deemed in Israeli time. And so, Joshua through Samuel, their heavy focus is on the larger, more prominent leaders. They focus a lot more on people like David and Saul and Joshua and just more of like the specific people, the specific big leaders of the group rather than the entirety of Israel. And so their mission was not for the larger group, rather for the kings and the private audiences. And so that's why they are joined as one, I guess, subsection inside this, the Nevi'im, the bigger section, is the former prophets. And so they focus on the specific people. In the latter prophets, there's a huge difference in the writing styles. These are more so poetry and less narrative form and just a lot of like speeches and oracles and poems and things written. And they were focused on the bigger audience. I mean, people like Isaiah and Jeremiah, especially, they were talking to all of Israel, or they were talking to all of Babylon, or they were talking to just larger groups, all of Egypt, things like that. They were talking to the larger group rather than the minute individual people. And so that's what makes them very, very different. And then the order of the major prophets in the latter prophets, we have the major prophets, which is Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, and those are placed in chronological order, while the minor are placed in diverse time periods and themes. And so it's kind of starts off going in chronological order, and then after that you can see is that prophets like Hosea and Micah, they were kind of a lot in different places, more so near each other, rather than, oh yeah, Hosea was the first prophet, and then it was Joel, and then it was Amos. They're kind of mixed up throughout the end of the Nevi'im. So that's kind of a crash course very quickly on the Nevi'im, what it is and what it contains. And so what is significant about the Nevi'im? And so basically the entirety of the Nevi'im is all about the consistent resistance of God's will in the life of the Israelites. And it begins after the new generation enters the promised land and begins the long strain of disobedience to God. This is kind of where we see Israel doing this back and forth motion of running after Jesus, not Jesus, running after God, and then running away from God. Jesus is not here, but he's talked about, which we'll get into here in a minute. So you're able to see a lot of the back and forth swaying of the Israelites, and we'll then get into later what is the significance of this and why we need to know this. But let's start from the first former prophet, quick crash course through all of the prophetic books. Here we go. Joshua.
Yeah, Joshua. Joshua's a good book. They're all good. The prophets are really good. So we left off last podcast. Moses is dead.
Yeah, Moses dies.
So that's kind of important because Moses was not allowed to go into the promised land. And so he's dead. Now Joshua has control. Joshua has the reins. And he is given charge to lead the people into the promised land. And so he's like presented as the new Moses,
mm-hmm.
Who eventually in chapter 8, he renews the covenant because they have to do that like a bajillion times because Israel fails. But he renews the covenant in chapter 8. But before then, he like leads the people into the promised land and starts trying to like conquer the land and take over all the people. So that's where you get the stories of Rahab, which is in chapter 2, and that's like a really cool story, and Rahab ends up being a part of Jesus's
lineage. Yeah.
And she's also like the one who gives birth to Boaz, which is then go to Ruth, and that's just a really cool thing, so you need to look that up. I won't go into that because it's a lot, but Joshua, the first, we'll like break it down. The chapters 1 through 12 is them entering and conquering the promised land. Chapters 13 to 22 is instructions for distributing the portions of the land, so to all the tribes, get a different part of the promised land. And then chapters 23 and 24, Joshua's dying, and he's like, peace out, good luck. And so there's a lot of really good stories in the book of Joshua.
Yeah.
The crossing of Jordan is one of them,
yeah.
Which is in chapter 3. You got Jericho, which is a really weird, crazy story.
Yeah, that's weird.
And if you really want to understand that, I recommend watching the VeggieTales version of it because it's actually really entertaining. So the second half of the book is really them just dividing up the land after they had kind of conquered it. So Then, after Joshua, Israel abandons its covenant partnership with God and begins a centuries-long history of apostasy and covenant rebellion. If you don't know what apostasy means, it means they walked away from their faith, basically. So, good. That sucks for them. All right, now, entering the book of Judges. Judges is my favorite book of the Old Testament.
She does not stop saying this. She says it every day.
It's so good, but so weird. And disclaimer, the book of Judges is very disturbing.
This is on the notes. She wrote, disclaimer, the book of Judges is rather disturbing.
I wrote it down because people, like, need to know that, like, Judges is a really, there's a lot of really awful, disturbing things that happens in the book of Judges, but it's so important to read it because you just really understand, like, the character of God through 100%. The whole book and really through the whole prophets. But, okay, let's dive into Judges. So, Judges starts with the death of Joshua and then tells the story of Israel's total failure. The whole book of Judges is just Israel failing. It's basically the whole prophets.
Yeah, Israel just sucks. Failing.
But Judges especially... the name of the book is rather misleading because they aren't judges like we think of a judge. Like, they don't sit in a court with a hammer and is like, yes, you go to jail and you go to jail. That's not how it works. They're more like military leaders or like tribal chiefs. So they are people that God raised up to lead. We'll get into that later. Anyway, so, I want to, hold on. Pause. Yes. Okay. It's important for me to read this in Judges before we get on to the rest because this kind of sets it up. So, Judges chapter 2, it says, it's talking about Joshua dying. Chapter 2, verse 7, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. And then it just kind of talks about where Joshua is buried, so skip down to verse 10. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work he had done for Israel. So, he's making a point here, whoever the author is of Judges. Do we know who the author is of Judges? I don't know.
I don't know.
Anyways, should have looked that up. My bad.
That's true.
Whoever the author is making a point that after Joshua, the next generations of people did not know God. They didn't follow the Lord. They didn't follow the covenant. None of that stuff. So now we're getting into the actual book where Israel is a mess.
Yeah.
So they're supposed to drive out the Canaanites, who were the group of people that were living in the land before Joshua led the Israelites there. But they didn't do that. So what happened was Israel became like the Canaanites. What's that thing you said earlier?
I said that they are who they hang around. Yes. Because they were hanging out with the Canaanites and they became like the Canaanites.
Which were very terrible people.
100%.
Which you find out if you read the book of Judges.
And like that's such a theme in the Proverbs as well. Like making sure that you pick like very specific friends. Because you can turn into, if you hang out with the wicked, you can turn into the wicked. And so another reason why we need to be familiar with the Old Testament. But we'll get into that later.
Yes.
Sorry, keep going.
So basically we have like a cycle of terribleness in the book of Judges that just continues, and that cycle is them sinning against God, then they're oppressed because they sinned against God, and God was like, all right, well, I guess I'm giving you over to your own sin, and then they're like, oh, maybe we should repent because this life that we're living in oppression is really terrible, so God, please come and save us. And then because God is great and merciful, he's like, okay, I will deliver you from these evil people, and then they have a period of peace. But then here comes the old habits, and it's just a cycle of, okay, sin, oppression, repentance, deliverance, peace. So that's what it is, over and over and over again. And you find that throughout all of the prophets. It's not just in the book of Judges. But it's interesting because the very end of Judges, the very last verse, it ends with, in those days Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes, which kind of sets up the next few books because they just decided that we don't need God, we're going to do whatever the heck we want. Mm. Enter in Samuel.
Oh, so, boy.
Also, you should go read Judges. There's some really funny stories in there, but I don't have time to talk about them. But Judges 3 is the best one. Okay, so Samuel.
Oh, boy.
Samuel starts the monarchy period of the Bible, which we learned in this book that Emma and I have been reading called The Blue Parakeet, which you should...
Also read
because it's really good. So Israel demands a king in chapter 8 because they like, well, we want to be like everyone else because everyone, all the other nations have a king. Why can't we have a king? And mm-hmm. so God's like, all right, whatever. Samuel, go find them a king.
And so this is after God deliberately said, do not have a king.
Do not have a king.
In the Mosaic law.
Yeah, right. You do not need this. I am here. Yeah. Anyways, so Samuel goes on the hunt for a king, and he's like, ooh, Saul, that's a good idea. But just kidding, God said that. And so he appoints Saul as king in chapter 10, I think. And I'll read this quote from the Blue Parakeet. It says, this can be called the monarchical concession for God in order to discipline Israel to see that God's original way, theocracy, is the best way. God remains the one true God and king, but Israel gets a human king who is to be under God the king. So the kings that are appointed by Israel are still subjected to God the king. But we find that doesn't always end well because mm-hmm. the kings are corrupt because they're humans, just like the rest of us. And so they resist the will of God and they become corrupt, like, because they're sinful. And we all have a God complex, so...
Mm.
2 Samuel is about David, and David's great.
We love David.
We love David. David's a good king, a really messed up human, but we get a lot of information from David and the Book of Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
Most of Psalms. All right. Now we're going to kings. The kings is really easy to explain what that's about because it's about what?
The kings.
The kings. We meet Solomon and the kings. And he's interesting character. He's very wise, but he has lots of women, which is funny to me. I don't know why, but it is.
Wise with women.
He is responsible for building the temple, which I thought while I was reading this, it was really interesting that the tabernacle that's been around forever, he was used for like 400 years, more than 400 years until the temple was built. I thought that was kind of cool because that's like a really long time. But anyways, so it's believed that the temple was built on, we know the temple was built on Mount Moriah, but it's believed that it's the same place that Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac, which I thought was a really interesting fact. He built the temple in 7 years, and 7 is Jesus's number, so that's ironic.
There goes Jesus again.
Yep, and then the end of 1 Kings is... Elijah and Elisha,
mm-hmm.
Which are pretty important to understand their story, because Elijah gets referred to quite a lot.
Yes, and that's where the prophetic nature like comes in as well into the kings, which is also believed as to why it is in the prophets, similar to Joshua being the prophetic person of Joshua.
And in the New Testament, everyone is like, are you the new Elijah? Like, is this the new Elijah? And that's why, like, understanding Elijah as a prophet is important to understand a lot of future quoted
things.
There's a lot more kings in the Second Kings that I don't really know a whole lot about, but Emma does.
They're just a lot of really evil people. There's, like, 3, I think, good kings. In 2 Kings in our Bible, there are, like, after Solomon, there are, like, only 3 good kings out of the rest of the kings. And because the rest of the kings sucking it up, you know, doing horrible stuff, Israel has to go into exile, and it is a whole big thing, and it is not good.
Yeah.
But my favorite king after David was probably King Hezekiah. I love him. He's great. Hezekiah, we got Josiah was awesome, and I forget, there was like one more, I forget what his name is, but there was one more good king. But there's a lot of kings in the kings, that's evident, lots of bad stuff, Israel sucks it up.
You should read it, it's pretty entertaining.
Read it, it's really interesting.
All the books we've just talked about are super entertaining books, because there's a lot of really crazy stories that you're like, what the heck is going on?
And people miss it because everyone's afraid of the Old Testament.
I know!
So y'all...
They're so good, you have to read it.
You have to go
you
read
have
it.
To read Judges, because you're like, what the dump is going on? It's so entertaining. Okay, anyways.
Oh, can I talk about 2 Kings for a second real fast?
Yes, okay. You can.
Another notable thing that I just love. So we got 2 Kings 19. I love 2 Kings 19. It's so fun. And so 2 Kings 19 is after Jezebel. We hear about a lot of, like, the... Oh, she has a spirit of Jezebel in her. It's like, Jezebel was horrible, queen, evil, disgusting. Like, Satan was definitely within her, like, horrible. And so, because Elijah was showed up the Baal, like, worshippers and things like that, and, like, there's a whole, like, Elijah asking God to bring fire down from heaven. That's a whole other story. You gotta go read.
That's a good one, too.
It's great. And so Elijah shows up these prophets of Baal or whatever. And God is obviously more powerful than their pagan God that doesn't exist, actually. And so Jezebel's mad, and she basically declares that Elijah is going to die because of her by the end of the day. And so Elijah, freaking out, he doesn't want freaking Jezebel to come get him. And so he runs away in the desert, and he goes, and he's like, God, just kill me. And so God sends an angel to give him food and have him take a nap. And so he wakes up, and he still wants God to kill him. He still wants to die. And so God gives him more food and has him take another nap. And then we have the whole, like, God, like, speaking to Elijah, and it's, like, Elijah did not hear God in, like, the earthquake. Oh, my. Elijah did not hear God in the earthquake. He did not hear God in the fire. He heard him in the quiet whisper, blah, blah, blah. And so then we have Elijah gets taken to heaven, which is exciting. And what's really interesting is that, I think 1 Kings 19 is where the other stuff was. I'm sorry. So 2 Kings chapter 2, Elijah gets taken up to heaven. And what's interesting is that after Jezebel makes this point to say that Elijah is going to die, he never dies. Like, he gets taken up to heaven. And so God is like, yeah, in your face, I have victory again. And I just think that's really cool and shows the power of God and how he's in the little details.
Yep.
Especially like that. So
God's
sorry.
God's always about the details.
I love it. I love that story so much. So I had to say it. Holly, take over for Isaiah.
Okay. Now we're moving into a different form of writing.
Very different.
And a little bit confusing. So Isaiah is now... So we're getting kind of into the... We got, like, the major prophets and the minor prophets, but as I've been doing this research, I don't really like calling it that. Like, I like that we just call it the prophets, because really the only reason why we call them the major prophets and the minor prophets is because Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel are, like, giant books, and
yep.
The other prophets are just a lot smaller, but that doesn't mean that what, say, Joel is saying is any less important than what Isaiah said 100%. In his 66 chapters in his book. So, I would recommend to just avoid calling them that, because what we know as the minor prophets are so good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, they're just harder to read. So, Isaiah. The overall genre of this book is prophecy. But the purpose isn't to only tell the future, but to express the author's sense of Israel's place in God's overarching, why was that so hard for me to say? Overarching redemptive plan for the world. The book, like, lacks a narrative line. So we just came from the books we just talked about were pretty easy to follow because it was following, like, a story.
Mm-hmm.
Where these ones aren't really following a story. It's more of a collection of, like, individual writings and thoughts. So it would be like us journaling.
Basically.
And then now people are reading it hundreds of years later. So Isaiah does denounce greed, hypocrisy, idolatry, and other sins against God, but he's also known for prophesying Jesus Christ, which is super cool. Isaiah is mentioned, I quoted this from my ESV study Bible. Isaiah is mentioned by name in the New Testament over 20 times and is quoted there extensively, for the message he preached is the very gospel of Jesus and the apostles. This just proves more that everything in the Bible always points to Jesus, which we've already talked about that. Isaiah also talks about, in chapter 6, verse 13, it says the holy seed is its stump. And if you do more research on that and read the context of it, which I don't have time to really go into, he's still prophesying Jesus Christ and talking about the seed that comes from, the woman that we know in Genesis 3, I believe. So it goes all the way back to Genesis when they're talking about the woman's seed and then the line of Jesus, and then I already talked about Rahab and all that stuff. And so later in Isaiah, he's talking about Jesus, or the Messiah, who we didn't know was Jesus at that point, is coming from the line of David, which Isaiah also prophesies, and that's what he's talking about in chapter 6 and a billion other times in the book of Isaiah. So Isaiah's really good. You should read it. It's very confusing.
Ignore the garage.
Yeah, ignore that.
Lord.
Isaiah's pretty interesting to read. And there's a lot. There's 66 chapters, yeah. And a lot of it is confusing, so you really have to, like, dig deep if you want to understand what the heck is going on. Okay, now we're moving to Jeremiah.
Woo!
Jeremiah's pretty much the same. I don't really have a whole lot to say about him. But he does prophesy in chapter 6. He says the army from the north is going to come and destroy the temple, which ends up happening. And we know now that what he means, the army from the north, is actually the city of Babylon coming to conquer, which they did, and they did destroy the temple. So that sucks. But so Jeremiah's like warning them, hey, this stuff is going to happen because you broke the covenant. This army from the north is going to come and destroy all these things and blah, blah, blah. And Israel's like, whatever. And so then God says, okay, well, I guess since you're not listening, Babylon will destroy Jerusalem and you're going to be exiled for 70 years. Yep. And that's exactly what happened. Woo. So the rest of the book is talking about that. So if you want to read that, go read that. It's pretty interesting. Okay. Now we're coming into the book of Ezekiel, which is my favorite, prophet. And I think, I don't really know why, I think it's just because reading Ezekiel, like, really makes me have to use my brain power to understand what's going on, and that's why I like it so much, because it's not an easy read, but it's also really entertaining, because Ezekiel is full of beautiful imagery and symbolism, mm-hmm. And so you really have to pay attention to what's going on, and this is why it's important to read the Old Testament and the New Testament, because you're not going to understand the symbolism or the imagery or anything like that if you don't understand the rest of the Bible. Not 100%. Understand the Bible, but, like, at least know what's going on. The book of Ezekiel starts with him sitting in Babylon, having a vision of God sitting on his throne. I call it a throne chariot-looking thing, because that's what it is. And this is confusing for him because what is God's glory doing in Babylon? It's supposed to be above the Ark of the Covenant in the temple that's in Jerusalem. So we know that God's glory sits above the Ark of the Covenant, exactly. Which is in the temple. So in Ezekiel's mind, he's like, well, this doesn't make sense to me because your presence can't be here. It has to be there. So the first section of the book is opening up to explore and understand that question. Like, why? What is it doing here? Which we find out in a minute. So Israel again breaks the covenant, and then we're just going to call him Zeke, because that's what I'm going to call him. Zeke's appointed to warn the people about, hey, you broke the covenant again. This is what's going to happen now. So, this is the really interesting part of Ezekiel, is that he is not really told to go and, like, prophesy to the people. It's kind of more like he's told to go perform, like, a form of street theater, which is super funny and interesting. Yep. And one of the most, like, bizarre ways that he does this is he's playing the role of a scapegoat, acting like he was bearing Israel's sins. So he's laying on his side in the middle of the street, like, bounded by rope and eating food that is cooked over human poop. Yes. Yep. I said that correctly. Human poop. And this is a sign of what would happen during the siege of Jerusalem. So he is prophesying, but not like we have experienced in past prophets or future prophets. And so that's really interesting, but no one's listening to him, shocker, because no one ever does. And then we're kind of coming back to this temple, this vision that he's having. Zeke has a lot of visions, and this book is a lot, so I'm sorry if this is a lot of information. I will try to skip some of it so that you can go and read it for yourself. But the, chapters 8 through 11 is his visions of the temple. And what's happening is he's seeing people worshiping other gods inside and outside of the temple, which is, like, a big no-no. Like, you're not going to go worship some random dude in God's house. Like, that's just not going to happen. So the vision ends by seeing God's throne chariot thing moving up and away from the temple, which we already talked about from the beginning of the book. And so Israel's idolatry was so bad that God's presence just left, which is really sad. Like, that's a scary thing. So you don't want to be away from the presence of God, which is kind of what sinning is. So, anyways. So he didn't actually, like, abandon his people, but he, like, went into exile with them. And God promises he'll return a remnant back to the land, which we talk about that a lot, that there's just a remnant left, which we'll get to later. And this is when we first get introduced to the concept of God transforming them by removing their hearts of stone and giving them a heart of flesh. So we see that in chapter 11. We also see that in chapter 36. Yes, chapter 36. So that's really important to understand salvation too. But we'll get into that in a later episode, I'm sure. And then the rest of the book is just judgments on Israel, and he compares them to a lot of really funny things, like a burnt, useless stick, which is one of my favorites. And he's like, there's no hope. There is hope for Israel. Well, I'm sure at the time it was like, there's no hope, everything's on fire. But because in chapter 33, Jerusalem had fallen and the temple was destroyed, which we knew was coming because of the prophecy. So then the rest of the book the next part of the book is about the Valley of the Dry Bones, which is one of my favorite stories, but I don't have time to talk about it, so you need to go read chapters 36 through 38, really 39, because it's super interesting, and I just love it a lot, and maybe we'll do an episode on it someday. But, so, it ends with, there's hope for all creation. He has a vision of a new temple, so God creating a new temple and creating a new Garden of Eden, and that is the end of the last major prophet.
Ding, ding, ding,
ding, ding, ding. Okay, Ezekiel's really good. You should go read it, yes. But it's also 48 chapters, and it's a lot, so
yeah,
good
take
luck.
It slow. So, those were the three big boys. The major prophets, not because they are more important, but because there is a lot more information in those than they are in the minor prophets, which is the 12 minor prophets. And so we got the 12 minor prophets, you know. And these are very repetitive. They're all very great, and they all have a unique standpoint to Israel's rebellion and Israel running away. And they're all very unique, but they're also very repetitive. And so I want to kind of take one out and kind of talk about that one, and then give an overarching summary of the rest of the minor prophets. And this is my favorite prophet, my favorite Old Testament book, which is Hosea, which I've talked about before a lot. But Hosea is a beautiful story. It is, I want to say, 13 chapters. And it is basically the story of Hosea, who God appoints as a prophet, and he calls Hosea in the first three chapters to go and marry a prostitute named Gomer. And God wants Hosea, who is a God-filled man, like a wonderful man who will treat this prostitute Gomer with respect and love, and fell in love with this woman. And God wants Hosea to understand that the relationship that Gomer and Hosea have is very similar to the relationship God and Israel have. Gomer, a woman who is in prostitution, kept on going back to prostitution, even though Hosea was giving her as close as possible to unfailing love. But he's human, so it's not unfailing love, but a wonderful love, and trying to shower her with love and just tell her that he will take her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And Hosea is in anguish and heartbroken because Gomer keeps running away from him, and it's the exact same story of God with Israel, and it's also the exact same story of God with us. And so one of my favorite chapter in that book is chapter 2, and it talks about how God takes us into the wilderness and speaks tenderly to us, and because of his covenant, he is no longer our master, but he is our husband, and he marries us in the desert with us, and that's just beautiful. And so the minor prophets is a mixture of basically each minor prophet is set up in a way where it's God's judgment in the first however many chapters, the first chapter or whatever, and it's God's judgment on Israel or Babylon or whatever, on someone. And then in the latter half of the book, it's always brought back up with hope and restoration and God's grace and God's love. And what breaks my heart is that people are like, God is a totally different God than he is in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, he's just so wrathful and so judgmental. And it's like, you're not actually reading the books if you think that, because these Israelites deserved these punishments, right? They kept on turning away from the marriage they had with God, we talked about in Exodus in last podcast. And so they were deserving of wrath, and they were deserving of punishment, and they deserved to go to hell, but God still forgave and still had grace and still had love. And all of this, all these books and the Torah and also the Nevi'im were leading up to Jesus. And so the minor prophets, not necessarily because, again, not because they are not as important, because they are small, they are all about the continuous cycle of Israel running away from God and then God punishing them and then God restoring them. And so you need to go read them. They're all beautiful books. And even though it is about this similar topics, they all bring a new perspective to it. And it's gorgeous. We just finished reading these, Holly and I did together. And so what is the significance of these books? Why do we need to know these books if a lot of these prophecies were not about us, even though there is some prophecy in here about end times, about very much a Revelation-esque books. These are very apocalyptic style. And why are these important for us? And it is that we are the Israelites once again. Although that these prophets are not people that are rising up in our generation and our time and are prophesying these things about our time, the Israelites are a group of people that we can look at and see our reflection. Because we are constantly in this cycle of running away from God and then running back to God. And Holly and I were even talking about this today. She was telling me about a story about how she kind of got, her pride got in the way of her worship. And so God punished her with that and was like, hey, you're not doing this if you're not going to have a great, you're not going to do this worship opportunity if you're not going to have a good mindset on, you're not going to worship me and you're going to make yourself a God above me. And so he punished her. She remembers that story and he has restored and given her grace. And she is walking in the footsteps of humbleness and learning that. And that's the point of why God did all these things to the Israelites. It's like, sure, there was lots of war, there were lots of evil, there were lots of horrible people, and God also did use his wrath and showed his power, but he did not do that without showing his grace. And if he did it for them, he's going to do it for us. And so in America, especially in, there are lots of people and there's lots of things I see in social media that just anger me and make me so frustrated and so upset and things that I do that I look back on my life and I'm like, wow, why did I do that? I'm so upset, I'm so frustrated, and I can see where God restored me, and I know that God's going to restore the people. Some people in America, you can try to restore everyone. Not everyone's going to take his restoration. Not everyone's going to hold on to his grace. But these stories are stories we get to hold on to because we get to have hope that God's going to do it again for us, and he's doing it still for us every single day. And more so for a logical standpoint rather than just an emotional, all of these books are quoted in the New Testament. And if we want to understand who Jesus was and we want to understand what Jesus was all about, we got to understand what he said. A majority of what he said was quoting scripture. And so if we want to understand what he said and where his heart was, we have to understand the scripture that he was saying. And that is all through the prophets and all the prophecy. And so as Holly mentioned earlier, the big prophets, mostly Isaiah is a big chunk of it, was the messianic prophecy. Isaiah talks all about Jesus without saying his name. He just says the Messiah. And so we see Jesus from Genesis 1 is being, the stage is being set up for Jesus to come and restore. And it is because of Jesus that we don't have to continuously do these animal sacrifices. We don't have to, whatever. He is the lamb that has been shed for us that will forgive us for all the things, right? And so these stories are important to know to understand who God is. And his intimacy and his grace with us, because if he did it for them, he's going to do it for us. And also to understand who Jesus was and still is and what he is all about. And also to understand that we are able to relate to the sinful people of Israel in these stories. And to these are a reminder to turn away from our sin, to turn away from idolatry, because even though our idols don't necessarily look the same, they're still there. And turn away from idolatry and turn away from turning away from God, if that makes any sense, and to start running to him and worshiping him because he deserves all the praise. And so the book we're reading, The Blue Parakeet, which is awesome, we're in a chapter right now that talks about kind of what Holly mentioned, is that there's the theocracy, there's the monarchy, and then there's like the Christocracy, I think it's the last one. And so the theocracy is what the Israelites started as, and it was there was one king, and it was God. And it was just God, and he ruled over all, which is how it should be, because he knows best, and he knows what we should do, what shouldn't do, and so there should be only one king. And then it turned into, as Holly talked about earlier, the monarchy, which is Israel wants a king, right? And so Israel, all throughout the Old Testament, is under this monarchy, even though it should be a theocracy. And we see that Israel's destruction is even worse than it was before, because they disobeyed and they are now worshiping other things besides God because of this monarchy. And so when Jesus comes in the New Testament, which we'll get into in a few weeks, we have the Christocracy, which is Jesus coming in as the one and only King and helping us remember that it should be a theocracy. So theocracy and Christocracy kind of are united as one. And so we are awesome. We are informed readers, and we know that there is a hope, and there is a salvation, and there is a Messiah that has already come, and we're waiting for him to come again. And so it's important for us, even though we know that, to go back to the beginning and go back to how did all this lead up to Jesus. And so that is Nevi'im. Is a lot of information. This is 40 minutes of a lotness. But this is so important to know. And so,
you really need to read it.
For real. Don't be so good.
I feel like you said it earlier that people are afraid to read the Old Testament. Yeah. And it's true. People are afraid to read the Old Testament. And that's just because they don't understand it. And there's a lot of scary things. I mean, we already talked about it, but the Book of Judges, like, all in of itself is terrifying. Just because of all the disturbing things in it. Pretty sure there's one story about talking about dashing children's heads on the rocks.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And it's actually talked about in Psalms too, which is crazy. But it's like, stories like that, they don't make any sense, but they're important to read because just of what it's setting up. And so don't be afraid of the Old Testament. Actually get excited by it because the Old Testament is beautiful. And
100%.
The imagery and the symbolism and the writings and everything is just beautiful. And you just can't be afraid to dig into it because it's really important.
Yeah. So next week we got the Ketuvim, which is the writings, which is going to be really interesting.
That's gonna be another lot.
A lot of information. But I'm excited for y'all to hear from us. And I hope that you enjoyed this podcast. And Nevi'im, if you guys have any questions, feel free to DM us on Instagram, Captain and Christians Podcast on Instagram. DM us there, and we'll try to respond to you in an timely manner. But with all that being said, I'm Emma.
I'm Holly.
And we'll catch you on the flippity flop.
We can never get that right.